Listen, I think we were all hit with the news yesterday as far as the death of O.J. Simpson. If you're a sports guy like me, you know, you loved him as a football player, following him regarding his college career at USC, Heisman Trophy, all the accolades, Buffalo Bills draft pick, 2,000 yards against the Jets at Shea Stadium on a snowy day. I'll never forget it. But then you hated him, too, for the way he conducted himself as far as how he handled women and everything else. Did he, didn't he, as far as kill his ex-wife and her friend, which was, you know, we were all, like, mesmerized for a couple of years, 94, 95, the trial, 95 million people. So we kind of had a lot of different emotions yesterday, including my next guest, Dr. Carol Lieberman. She also wrote about him, you know, in her best-selling book, Bad Boys, Why We Love Them, How to Live with Them, and When to Leave Them. That's kind of a classic example of the Prince of Darkness, the abusive type. And all in all, no better person to converse as far as yesterday was concerned. And then Dr. Carol, who joins us from the West Coast. Welcome, Carol. Good morning. So give me, when you found out, what was your mindset? Emotions left and right? You covered this more than anyone. Give me a sense here.
Well, yes. My first thought was, somebody died. I should feel sad. You know, we tend to feel that way, even if we don't know the person. You know, obviously, if it's some friend or a loved one or something, obviously we're going to feel sad when we hear that they died. But even with celebrities, people often feel sad because they feel that they knew the person in a way. But when I heard OJ died, I felt, well, I should feel sad because someone died.
Right.
But how do you feel sad, you know, when he was a man who killed two people and just really beyond his glory football days, really created a lot of pain for people. So I think that I don't think I'm alone. I think the majority of people are having this oops kind of thing. Oh, I should feel sad. Oops. No, maybe I shouldn't. He was a bad guy.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's okay to have, I would think, you know, a couple of sets of emotions. You know, I started my career as a broadcaster in sports, and, you know, he was one of the greatest running backs in the history of the National Football League, one of the greatest runners in general, winning the Heisman, breaking records. You know, when they played a 14-game season, he ran for 2,000 yards in just 14 games. And he did it at Shea Stadium in Queens. I'll never forget it. But then, you know, there's the other side of things. As far as a spiraling, you know, we kind of hold athletes, you know, a little bit differently in life because of the adulation and everything else of what we witnessed. But then again, it's trying to handle the other side of things, Carol. When things go bad, when they spiral, when they turn out to be criminals. And in this case, you know, depending on how you feel, even that of a murderer, you know, the emotions that you feel, you just can't help here.
Yes, he was a real disappointment to all his fans, you know, people who did watch him for all those glory days. And then, you know, all of a sudden he was on trial for murder. Now, as people will probably remember, he was acquitted in his criminal trial, which was very, very shocking. Shouldn't have happened. But then he was found guilty in the civil case. And Ron Goldman's family and Nicole Brown Simpson's family brought against him, and they still have not been paid. The jury awarded them millions and millions of dollars, and OJ, you know, with his teams of lawyers, managed till the end to keep any money from them.
Mm.
Now, they're going to try, of course, to get the money now, you know, in his from his life insurance or whatever, his estate. But, you know, I'm sure he already had that tied up. It's you know, it's like he didn't want to give them any money. I mean, even after death, you know, I mean, yes, he had his own children and so on, who he would prefer to give the money to. But it was like, you know, I'll show you, you know, I didn't kill them. You don't deserve any money. I mean, that was really hateful.
No doubt, Carol Lieberman with us as far as OJ, the death, looking back on things and everything else. You know, let's get into the relationship a little bit with his ex-wife, because that was very contentious, as we all know and read and whatnot. And pretty much, Carol, if you look at the timeline with everything involved here, there were a lot of events. Colburn Simpson calling the police, if you remember the audio of that call and everything else, begging for some help from enforcement to come there. OJ was harassing her beyond belief, but this was a common tactic of OJ Simpson against Nicole Brown Simpson, correct?
Yes. I have a number of connections with him. I used to be on the news every day analyzing the trial.
Yeah.
And also, I wrote about him in my Bad Boys book, Bad Boys, Why We Love Them, How to Live with Them, and When to Leave Them. And I had talked about 12 different types of bad boys. And one of them was the Prince of Darkness type. And he was sort of the lead character, you know, the lead example of the Prince of Darkness. And that was a man who was abusive, you know, to the point, of course, he exemplified the kind of bad boy or Prince of Darkness who would kill, go so far as to kill his the woman he loved. And it's really interesting how the psychology behind men like that. And that is that the reason why they become so inflamed towards a woman is when they sense anything that indicates that she is going to abandon them. So with Nicole, you know, yes, they had a very contentious relationship, as you were saying. I mean, it started off lovey-dovey, but But then the night that he killed her, that was when they both attended a ballet recital of their daughter. And he saw that she was not coming back. He got the message finally. I mean, she had been trying to tell him before. They were separated, and he kept thinking they were going to get back together. But he could tell the way she looked at him, the way she talked to him that night, that no, there was no hope. They were not going to get back together. And that is what enraged him. And it comes, of course, from childhood. Everything comes from childhood. And it comes from a man having been abandoned by his mother during childhood in one way or another. And with OJ, his mother had another baby while he was still at her breast. And she took him away and then replaced him at her breast with the next baby. And also, his mother and father were getting divorced, and so his mother had to work a lot more because there were several kids, and so she worked as a nurse, and she would long hours, and she just wasn't around. So all of those things contributed to his being extra sensitive to a woman abandoning him, and Nicole Brown Simpson that night just pushed him over the edge.
Yeah, no doubt. Talking with Dr. Carol Lieberman on the OJ death and the events, of course, of the mid-90s. Carol, you know, a lot of people might forget, of course, you know, I think it kind of led to what occurred in the courtroom a couple of years later. But listen, how can you ever forget the Rodney King riots of Los Angeles, which pretty much almost burnt down the city entirely, the acquittal of the policemen and everything else regarding King, the outrage and everything else. That's when we got a taste as far as the racial divide of what was happening in this country back in 1992, it was, I believe, right, with Rodney King. How much did that contribute fast forward into the courtroom regarding OJ?
Well, OJ did make race the cornerstone of his case. You know, he used race to try to say that that if the jury convicts him, it would be because he's black, not because he's guilty. And, of course, his dream team lawyers, you know, made that the cornerstone. They showed that was going to be the case. And, you know, it was really sad to see that, you know, race should not be a part of a case, a part of a trial, a part of a verdict, no matter who it is and what the race is or what the people. I mean, that's just not that it should be based on facts and evidence and all of that, not race.
Yeah, but you know, as it turns out, and jumping around here, as we got into the case and into the courtroom and everything else, You know, apparently was, at least according to the Los Angeles Police Department, with how they handled everything. I mean, my goodness. You know, it seemed like they had the guy dead to rights and everything else, but they fiddled around with the evidence, the bloody sock, not knowing a special chemical was involved there. If you heard Alan Dershowitz speak out over the last couple of days, I mean, Dershowitz really, you know, kind of set it in stone. He, of course, part of that whole dream team of lawyers for Simpson. But in essence, you know, when you have the LAPD conducting business as they did, you couple that with the Mark Furman testimony, one of the lead guys, and the N-word and everything else that he used, his racial happenings from his past being brought up methodically, being brought up by guys like Johnny Cochran and F. Lee Bailey and Robert Shapiro. I mean, my goodness. You know, when you have a dream team like that, you find a little bit of a loophole. Guess what? You give yourself a chance. And that's what happened as far as the jury was concerned. But the real focus to me is the evidence and how they went about that. Carol, talk to me a little bit about that. Go ahead.
Well, yes. I mean, they made some mistakes, absolutely. Especially, remember, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit with the gloves.
Which, by the way, Christopher Dawdon was not ready for prime time. Now, he could have had that whole thing done outside of the courtroom as far as Simpson and that glove. He decided to make it a spectacle on primetime TV. And boy, did that backfire. Go ahead.
Yes. Which didn't mean that it wasn't his. You know, it's just that it's right up after all those, you know, after all the time that went between the murder and the case, you know. But yes, they were not. They were out lawyered. The prosecutors were out lawyered.
Yeah, I mean that's really what it was. They were out lawyered and everything else. And listen, Johnny Cochran was going to take advantage of it. We know that, and he did. And that was the tipping point, as far as that's concerned. It's amazing to me still how Marsha Clark and Chris Dawdon would be the lead prosecutors in this particular case. Can you recollect, go back with us in time and give us as far as the selection in that regard, when maybe their qualifications might not live up to what was to come here?
Well, I know there was all this sort of controversy who was going to be the prosecutors, who were going to prosecute this case. I don't really remember all the details of how they, I mean, Chris, actually, a funny, well, not funny, but like an interesting story, Chris Dawdon, after this case, had retained me for the Eric Holder case, the case against Nipsey Hussle, because... you know, he's still, I mean, he's a practicing lawyer. He actually recused himself from, do you remember the Nipsey Hussle case?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, I remember that.
He recused himself from it, ultimately, because he was getting so many threats against his life for representing the man who they, you know, charged with the case, with the killing. But yes, I remember there was all this confusion and politics and all that in the DA's office when they ultimately picked the two of them. But I mean, the thing is also there were so many more. The Dream Team had so many more people, more attorneys, and even just that, you know, in general, the prosecutor's office has less to work with and less people to do investigations. And I mean, I'm talking about cases even till today that if you have a really good dream team, you know, you're going to win. Well, I mean, you have a better chance of winning. So that was a problem. Also, you know, do you remember the movie, the documentary really about OJ that was just a few years ago, about five years ago?
Yep.
It was where it basically showed him essentially admitting, I did it.
Yes, exactly. And it's and a matter of fact, listen, he's done some interviews where he kind of, you know, implicated himself in this whole thing.
Yes.
It's almost like he was wanting to tell a story. One particular interview, I think her name was Judith Regan.
Yes.
But Carol, it's interesting. You know about this, but it's almost as if he has inserted himself as far as actually being the killer there.
Yes, yes. Well, and there was a book that came out.
Yeah.
If I did it, and the way that they did it, there was controversy about, the title.
Yeah.
About, you know, if I did it. And so what they ended up agreeing to was putting the if, like the big words, the big title was I did it. And then the if was a little size in the I. So, I mean, yes, there were, and some, a writer, I actually interviewed him on my radio show, a writer wrote that book. And, he, you know, there was a whole big controversy. They were worried about O.J. kind of admitting in that book or in those interviews with this writer that he did do it. So, you know, but by then it was too late to bring him back. He had to be tried twice. So he was feeling emboldened. And that was kind of part of his big problem to begin with. And the part of the story that people who get to feel so big, I mean, get to be big and then feel so that they can do no wrong and nobody can bring them down. That was basically his problem.
Yeah, without question. And Carol Liebman with us. Let's kind of fast forward a little bit, jump around here. So he gets acquitted October 1995. You know, it was almost like the cliffhanger of Dallas, or Who Shot JR, you know, one of the league soap operas, whatever you want to correlate it to. But
right.
We all were glued to the screen and the acquittal and everything else. In fact, his suit is in some sort of a museum, the beige suit. I mean, this is how down to the T you get here. But in essence, that's what it became. OJ's a free man, the vitriol left and right, the Goldman's incense, civil suit, and whatnot, $33 million. By the way, that's elevated to around $100 million. He hasn't paid a nickel of that over the years. With interest and everything else. I can't even imagine how the Goldmans were feeling yesterday. You know, I mean, listen, they said it right yesterday. They said it right with a statement and everything else, because the father, you know, he thought about Ron, his son, even more so. Even yesterday, nobody could care less about OJ and his death and whatnot. But, you know, it was a lot of reflection, I would think, go on yesterday regarding his son. And that's what it was.
They've been suffering ever since that day because, you know, I mean, first of all, suffering because of the loss, but also suffering because of the way that OJ kept a penny. He didn't pay them a penny despite the court awarding them all these millions of dollars. So it was kind of a slap in the face every day, you know, every day that he wouldn't, that he found more ways, or his lawyers found more ways to hide his money from them.
No question about it. And that's what happened as far as, you know, what happens with the estate now and if they can recoup any dollars. And I guess, you know, with Ron Goldman, Carol, he was at the wrong place, wrong time. Restaurant he worked at on the way home, wanted to return a pair of glasses from Nicole Brown. Went to the door and met his fate that night. Just wrong place, wrong time for him, correct?
Yes. Well, OJ thought, you know, that they were having an affair.
Right.
He didn't know what the connection was between the two of them, and he always was so jealous of Nicole. He always thought she was having, because he didn't feel good enough. I mean, that was really the bottom line. He didn't feel good enough to have her, to be married to her, for her to be in love with him. She really was in love with him. I mean, at the beginning, she really was. And that's why she was just, it was so terrible for her to have this change, you know, that for him to become so jealous and to become, I mean, before Ron Goldman, like he all the time, this is typically of what abusive men do. He would look at her odometer, where she went. You know, he'd always have to know where she was. He was always afraid that she was going to be finding somebody better than he was.
Carol, to this day, do you think, well, I mean, I get a sense that I could say, I won't put words in your mouth, that you feel he should have been guilty, but do you feel that he acted alone in this? Did he get some help? What do you think about all that?
Well, you know, there was a rumor going around after the killing, and it really got traction. And I don't know. I guess there is. I haven't totally. I mean, there is a little thing that says could it be his son? That the rumor was that his son, either his son did it or his son helped him. And that has never gotten to a court, you know, it's never been tried. And, you know, now it's not going to happen. But I've heard it from a number of people who could have been or claim to be in the know. So I can't say that that's true, but it did kind of make me wonder.
And not only that, a lot of people forget when this took place, those two kids were in the house, Justin Simpson and the daughter, Sydney. And, you know, a lot of people have not really delved into that from an emotion standpoint and everything else of what they felt. And, of course, growing up over the years, they haven't made a lot of comment on that, have they?
No, of course, that traumatized those children. And, yeah. They've never, that's been the number one event of their life, of course. And it was really, really traumatic.
Yeah, unbelievable. And you, one other point I want to make, you know, it's so interesting to me with this happening, Carol, 30 years ago, it'll be in June, how things have changed from a technological standpoint. And I'm talking about collecting evidence, DNA, familial DNA, you know, all of the nuances involved now with police work and collecting evidence and blood and whatnot here. It just shows, I guess, in a positive way of how far we have come in order to solve cases. And sometimes, you know, cold cases and everything else, we've seen cases solved over a 30, 40-year stretch. That's amazing in itself over the last three or four decades, you know?
Yes, if he had done this crime today, I think there would have been a lot more proof. Even if the LAPD did screw up, there would be a lot more proof, you know, because of the advances in forensics. But I just want to make something clear. I was talking about his son, who may have the rumors that his son did it and or may have helped him do it. I was talking about Jason Simpson, his older son. Not
right.
Justin.
Good point. Good point. That's because he had two. Justin was the young one, very young one
right.
at the time, obviously.
Right.
And he had one from his first marriage, Margarita, I believe. He had a couple of kids. One of them, by the way, drowned, died young. So that is something to keep in mind. And that's an excellent point. So I guess the chapter closed and everything else. And we haven't received word yet. We know he passed on Wednesday, whether penance given or not, as far as a confession, you know, we'll never know that either with family and friends there.
Do you know, he made his, the people in hospice and then the people who were at his deathbed made them sign a non-disclosure agreement. I'm not sure what he was, maybe he made a deathbed confession. Maybe that's what he didn't want them to tell.
Yeah. Fascinating. A chapter close, a lot of reflection. It's almost as if, you know, you compare it to JFK and Lee Harvey Oswald. If he had any help, did OJ have help? Did OJ do it? Did he hire someone to do it? You know, these are all unanswered questions, and who knows if we will ever see the light of day as far as getting a solidified answer, but just fascinating times and closing the books as far as OJ Simpson is concerned. Dr. Carol Lieberman, well done as far as going back into memory lane there, my dear. You stay well.
Thank you. You too.